Let's bring the lights up and want to invite you to reach under the seat in front of you or underneath your own seat. You'll find a red-orange pew Bible. This has been our custom for years now on Wednesday nights. We began 11 years ago, starting in Genesis. We began the book of Romans about a year ago, I think last summer or so, and we're up to Romans chapter 13. So if you're using the red pew Bible and you don't have your own Bible, if you have your own, please feel welcome to use that. But if you're using the Pew Bible, Romans chapter 13 is on page 162 in the back half of the book. You'll definitely want to turn there. You want to have this text in front of you because we're going to be looking at it in detail as we wrestle with what for some is a very controversial and challenging issue. And for others, it just seems to make common sense. It's a challenging, controversial, difficult passage we're looking at tonight. It's been abused again and again, and yet that doesn't necessitate that it's a bad passage. It just means we've got to try to understand what it means, what it's really saying. So Romans chapter 13. Now Romans 12, and we began this a few weeks back, is where Paul begins to address the big question. And the big question, of course, always is, how then should we live? If God is God and God has graced us in Christ and we have these mercies that have been shown us, how do we live? Well, Paul begins Romans 12 with, I beseech you, therefore, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, make your bodies a living sacrifice. So the individual commitment to being connected to and loving of God and sacrificially living a life of worship. He then moves on and speaks about how the church is to share in its gifts so that that life of faith exists within a community of faith. He then moves on in chapter 12 to talk about sincere love among brothers and sisters, and then even extends it into the culture, the local community. Honor that which others honor in your community. Make sure that you love. And he does that always extending the embrace of who he's including in how we live our life. And he's going to take that to its widest extent when he speaks about government. Because he's now going to speak about the Christian's relationship to the government under which they exist, our relationship to governing authorities. Now, as I said at the beginning, many instantly recoil from this passage, and you might see why as we read through it. In fact, it might not be a bad idea just to read through the verses we're going to be looking at so you can get a bird's eye view of what we're going to be delving into. Paul starts in chapter 13, verse 1, if you're all there with me. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority, resist what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you'll receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject not only because of wrath, but also because of conscience. For the same reason, you should also pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. Pay to all what is due them, taxes to whom taxes are due, revenue to whom revenue is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due. Now, there are some that say Paul has really gone off the bridge here at this point, and we just need to take this, chuck it, and just live in a democracy. But I don't think that's really the right way to approach this. The text has certainly been abused, and it's been abused very badly. It was used in the 1930s by leaders of the German church as reason to support Hitler's Third Reich. It was used in South Africa to gain Christian cooperation during the apartheid regime in South Africa. It's been used for some very troubling situations, and therefore you can see why people recoil and take a step back and say, well, maybe we ought to just, you know, kind of mark this one out of the Bible all together. But I want to, and you know this has been our task ever since we began with Genesis, look at the text first. I want to try to understand what is really being said before we decide whether to include or not to include this, because let's face it, you can twist a lot of parts of the Bible, and if we decide to chuck out every part that can be twisted, we'll have very little left. Just about anything that's true can be perverted and twisted and abused and used in horrific ways. That doesn't take away from the fact that we are to put our minds to work. We're trying to conform our mind to the truths of Scripture to understand what Paul is trying to get at here as he's addressing this small minority church in Rome, and perhaps see how it applies to us in our present day experience of government. And after all, by the time we're done with this passage, we may find that it doesn't mean at all what its abusers have concocted it to mean. So I want to look at this text with you, and it begins with this all-expansive command, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except from God. And so Paul's first idea here is, you know, authority exists because God gives it as a gift. Now that's not writing a blank check to governing authorities. He's actually, if you listen to him, saying you authorities exist because of a greater authority. Nero and all subsequent emperors would have laughed at such a suggestion. Nero and the Caesars believed they were in authority because they were gods. That they held the power, that even if they weren't gods, and you had to think, sometimes they had to question in their mind whether they were gods or not, but perhaps if you're narcissistic enough, you can think you're a god. If they didn't think they were a god, they felt that they at least held power in their own right. It wasn't a gift from God. They'd earned it, they'd deserved it, they'd gathered it, they'd perpetuate it. So no Caesar, no emperor, no governor would hear what Paul is saying and say, you're right. Authority is a gift from God. He's already being subversive. He's saying, you all exist under another authority. And when he says this, he's saying no more than what Jesus said when he was before Pilate. When he said to Pilate, you would have no power over me unless it had been given you from above. So Paul is stating that very same thing within the context of governing authorities, and the reason why he wants to suggest that authority is a gift from God is because God's a God of order and not of chaos. Because let's face it, order is always better than chaos. When chaos and anarchy reign, then the powerful, the rich, and the bullies come out on top. Get that. Follow me on that. When chaos and anarchy rule, then the bullies, the powerful, the rich, they're going to come out on top. We're living by the law of the jungle at that point. Paul doesn't want to, neither does the Scripture ever endorse this living by the law of the jungle. From Genesis 1, chaos is there and God brings order to the chaos. God is a God of order instead of chaos and anarchy. And the order that the governing authorities are to preserve is this. They are to restrain evil. You see that in verse 2. Therefore, whoever resists authority, resist what God has appointed. Those who resist will incur in judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. So that in Paul's thinking, the ideal is that government is a gift from God. He's not suggesting that everyone there is, you know, innocent and perfectly good. And he's not even assuming it's all good government. He's writing this while Nero Caesar is the emperor. Caesar hasn't gone all bad at this point, but he's on the precipice of going bad. And yet still, he's certainly unjust in some ways. He's imperfect, and yet Paul sees in some way God is a God that would rather have order than absolute chaos and anarchy. And so Paul says, you know, the whole point of government, at least one of its primary functions, is to restrain evil. And laws do that pretty well. That's the function of laws in general. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not steal. And government has the ability to enforce those thou shalt not. So government does a great job when it's restraining evil and it's able to punish infractions and evildoers who go beyond the boundaries of what's commanded not to do. Where government often falls short and where laws fall short is it's hard to put into law what you should do. Enforcing thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not steal is easy. Enforcing love your neighbor, be merciful to one another, love your enemy, which is the Christian's call. You can't enforce that. You can't adjudicate that. That's where all of a sudden you realize law always falls short in some ways. That doesn't mean it's bad, it just means it's ability is limited, and government, according to Paul here, has the role of at least enforcing laws so that evil is restrained. So that if someone murders someone, then there are infractions, there are judgments, there are punishments to that. If someone steals, there is a way to enforce that. You could summarize all that we've said so far with the 1930s theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, where he says, God's goodness makes civil order possible. The corruption of human nature by sin makes such civil order necessary. Niebuhr is getting at the point, which I think Paul is, that government's always necessary because evil flourishes when it's unchecked, when there's nothing to restrain it. Then the law of the jungle reigns, bullies run the show, the rich, the powerful, and all the rest suffer because of it. And so with that in mind, with this idea that there's a restraint to evil, Paul is telling his people that they need to do what's right, they need to go along with government, particularly when it's restraining evil as it's supposed to, so that verse 3, as we've already looked at, rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Well, do what we're supposed to be doing. Do what is good and you'll receive its approval. Now, notice when Paul says that, he has to know that he himself has been imprisoned unjustly 3 or 4 times in the book of Acts. He also has to know that Jesus himself was executed unjustly. It's not necessarily always true that if you do what's good, you'll receive its approval. You may do what's good and not receive its approval when it's not behaving rightly, when it's not adjudicating rightly. But Paul's not dealing with the exceptions here. Paul's dealing with the ideal of what government is there for and why the Christians that he's addressing that are a small, tiny minority in Rome need to, as best as possible, be good citizens and supportive of that government to the extent that they're able to be. Verse 4, for it is God's servant for your good, but if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid. For the authority does not bear the sword in vain, which is to say that government has the power to enforce its laws, to punish its infractions. This is why you never want the church and state to be in such deep collusion and conflation that you don't know which is which, because the church does not have the power of the sword. We're not called to adjudicate in this kind of definitive way. Paul's even mentioned at the end of chapter 12, do not take vengeance upon your enemies. You know why he said that and why he's moved to Romans 13? Because if there's an enemy and they've done something against the law, say they've murdered someone, it's the state or the government's duty to enforce and to adjudicate and to punish. It is not the individual's duty to do that. And so Paul is speaking of government in a very general way, but he's speaking of it as a restrainer of evil, and he's inviting the Christians to make sure they're supportive of this restraint of evil insofar as they are able, and to do it with a clean conscience. Verse 5, therefore one must be subject, not only because of wrath, in other words, because you fear punishment or you fear judgment, but because you want to have a good conscience before God. And this is where he says some verses which I know some people are not going to like, but it's just right there. This is why you pay taxes. For the public servants, for the government, for the order, for the structure. And Paul's saying that in a position where he has no say in his government, where he has no voice or vote, where, you know, it is the monarchy that's ruling and he's subject to whatever whims they desire. And he still is saying, you know, this is why we pay taxes. We're not going to stop paying taxes because Jesus is Lord. We still have some obligations to Caesar. And so we pay our taxes. We pay verse 7 to them what is due. Taxes to taxes, revenue to whom revenue, respect to whom respect, and honor to whom honor is due. So Paul speaks of being subject so that we have a good conscience, so that we're honoring authorities and so we're paying taxes. Now that's our text, and we're done with the text. He's going to move on to how the law really falls short and everything, and we'll look at this next week, verse 8, just to get a taste. Owe no one anything except to love one another, for the one who loves one another has fulfilled the law, which is Paul's subtle way of saying, you know, at the end of the day, the law is helpful, but if you really want to get at what the heart of the law is about, it goes way beyond law. It goes to the debt of loving your neighbor, loving one another. But we'll look at that next week. Right now he's dealing with almost total law, complete policy, all government, all enforcements and infractions and reward for good behavior, which allows me to have this longer than necessary reflection. Because I want to try to get at what I think this text is saying, because I refuse To be honest, and I'll be just up front, I refuse to upchuck and spit out any text in Scripture. I think it's there for a reason. It may not mean what some think it means, but I just have a resistance to deciding what is sacred text and what's not. The church did that work for me centuries ago. I just have the issue of trying to understand it and to live under it. My job isn't to criticize it and toss out what's not appealing to me. That's just not my style. I'd rather figure out what's it mean and how does it fit, and for the most part, many controversial texts usually don't mean what some you do think it means when they use it to abuse and to harm others and to beat people over the head. So the first thing that I draw from this is that Paul, in many ways, is really trying to do one thing. He's trying to get the believers in Rome to be good citizens, to be not a threat to the Roman rule around them. And you know why? The Christians in Rome are a super small minority. See, the sad thing in our culture is we assume we're in the majority. And we assume everything should be Christian and everything should kind of align with what our faith says because we've lived, in fact, our Protestant mainline, whole mainline idea is that we're in the mainline, baby. We're the ones with a big say. People should listen to us. Well, that's no longer true and we need to get used to it because it's not going to be true again in any of our lifetimes. That's not the case. In Paul's day, there wasn't even a sense of that being possible because the Christian movement was such a small minority in such a large empire. And the last thing Paul wants to do is to be hindered from preaching Jesus is Lord, the King has come, Messiah has arrived, because the Christians are held of being suspicious of being subversive, being suspicious of being violent rebels. He does not want that. He doesn't want the government to get on them and destroy them at the bud, at the beginning of this movement. And so Paul is not in our place. He's not in a place where he has a voice and vote. He's not into democracy. He's in a much different setting. And he has such a small minority, even if it were a democracy, they'd never win. They'd never win. And so Paul's statement, quite clearly, in the most simplest of terms, is to say, hey guys, you don't have to always agree with the government. In fact, he'll warn in other places against participation in the patriotic emperor cult, in giving Caesar too much place. He'll warn and speak kindly and highly of Moses, who battled Pharaoh. Because that's part of our sacred story, that Moses doesn't sit back and let Pharaoh run the day. Moses says, hey, let my people go. And if you're not going to let them go, there's going to be trouble. So he knows his tradition. He's not giving a carte blanche, blank check to government. But as a general rule, he wants his followers to be model citizens, even in the pagan and unjustly structured society of the Roman Empire. N.T. Wright, I think, gets at the heart of what Paul's saying here just as simply as possible when he says these words. This is almost all that Paul is saying, N.T. writes, that the Christians who were regarded as the scum of the earth in Rome at the time must not get an additional reputation as troublemakers. No good will come to the cause of the gospel by followers of Jesus being regarded as crazy dissidents who won't cooperate with the most basic social mechanisms. That seems to be what Paul is saying on the surface. But as we move a little bit further, we have to ask ourselves, well, then, what do we do about the abuse? Because this text is surely troubling in some ways. Because if you read verse 1, it can sound like it is a blank check. Like it isn't offering any qualifications. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. Unconditional obedience to your rulers and to their laws. And that's how in the 1930s, some leaders in the German church said, well, this is why we need to support Hitler and the Third Reich. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities. This is why some would say during apartheid in South Africa, this is why Christians have to cooperate with that, because let every person be subject to the governing authorities. More recently, you might remember 2016-17, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, when he quoted this to defend the Trump administration policy of separating immigrant children from their families, he quoted Romans 13 as the defense, which he never would do for Obamacare, trust me. He used it when it was convenient, and people called him out on that, and they were right in calling him out on that, because he used it when it was convenient to do so. Clearly, this text has been used and it's been abused by people in power to tell subjects, do not resist. No matter what we do, you must not resist. You will honor us and you will do what we say. And that's why, dear friends, some critics will say, get rid of it. Just chuck the text. But here's why even the critics don't believe the words that are coming from their own mouths. Because the minute their house is burgled, the minute someone they love is murdered, the minute they are cheated in business, or perhaps even experience a bad sports call, they're going to be crying for authorities. The authorities should do something. They should restrain the evil. They should punish the evil. There needs to be some adjudication. There needs to be vindication. Isn't that true? You can say, you know, kind of with, you know, a certain naivete, yeah, let's just chuck this. We don't really need to worry about authorities until really we want an authority to make a decision and to do something because they're in a position to do something that we cannot do. That's when we want authority, because we don't want to live in a world where evil reigns unchecked. So yes, this text has been abused, but I want to suggest this. Maybe it's been abused because we're not looking at what Paul's really saying. Because if you notice what he's doing two things. He's relativizing governing authority. There is no authority except from God, which is to say every authority except for God's is under God. And thus it does not have a right to claim divine prerogatives. It doesn't have the right to claim that it's the absolute and ultimate authority. But here's our challenge, and this is a quick parenthesis. In a secular world where we've kind of decided God is irrelevant, there's no higher authority than the state. That's terrifying. When we decide that God is irrelevant, all of a sudden there is no other higher authority. The state does, by default, become God. But Paul here is saying something that those Caesars would not be happy with. That their authority is given by God, and therefore they are under God. And that's why Paul Ochtemeyer, the Presbyterian theologian, I think puts it so well when he says, in the first place, since governing authorities are in fact God's servants for the promotion of civil order, those governing authorities cannot claim for themselves divine prerogatives. A government that claims for itself the total and absolute devotion which a creature can give only to its creator ceases in the moment it makes that claim to be an agent of divine order or a divine servant. It has become instead an idolatrous opponent of the living God. That's why this isn't the only picture of the state in our New Testament. You know the other picture of the state? Many people don't kind of connect with this, but I hope you never forget this. The church, when it was experiencing the Roman government pressing down so that it was no longer restraining evil but had become an instrument of evil in church persecution, all of a sudden understood, yeah, there's another way to look at the state. It is a harlot riding on a beast in the vicinity of the false prophet who's boasting. Revelation 17 through 19, that's a picture of Rome gone wrong. And Rome gone wrong is when the harlot's on the beast, and the beast, instead of restraining evil, is now an agent of evil. Instead of it being something that rewards good, it is punishing good. It has become that which just helps unleash more evil rather than do what governing authorities are supposed to do, and that is to restrain evil. That's the first thing I thought when I remember Jeff Sessions said that. I just thought to myself, you know, that's not the only teaching about government in the early church. You can go to Revelation 17 through 19, and the church certainly understood when it was under deep persecution and the state had become an instrument of evil, that it was quite fine in subversive language to say that the governing authorities have become the beast. They've become the beast upon which the harlot rides and the false prophet boasts of its greatness. And so there is this sense in which Paul is doing his best to say, you know, we need to be good citizens, but authority, governing authorities, are relative. They have a limited authority. They are servants of God, and they're supposed to act in service of God in restraining evil and rewarding good. He also then, in doing this, says there's a limit to their authority. Because they are called to simply restrain evil, the limit to the authority is they are not to go beyond that. They're not to take the place of God. They have been given this service by God, whether they'd assent to that, acknowledge it, or recognize it in any way. So one last quote, and I'm using a lot of quotes tonight. I normally don't use this many, just because I other people say this better than I can. N.T. says it so well when he says, Romans 13 constitutes a severe demotion of arrogant and self-divinizing rulers. It is an undermining of totalitarianism, not a reinforcement of it. By implication, if the rulers themselves are given the task of judging wicked people within their sphere of authority, they themselves will be judged by the God who set them up. The key phrase in that is right at the top. It is an undermining of totalitarianism, not a reinforcement of it. This isn't a blank check that governing authorities can do what they will. They're called to restrain evil under the vestiges of God, who will call them to account for how they've done their job. There should be that same sense of trembling that a governing authority has that a pastor ought to have. James 3, let not many become teachers, for we shall incur a stricter judgment. You know, that's real warm, isn't it? I think about that often. Let not many become teachers. We shall incur a stricter judgment. We'll be judged by more severe standards because we've taken upon ourselves a great responsibility and a great privilege and a role that demands a certain kind of behavior. That's why I refuse to chuck out any of these texts, by the way, because that's not my job. I'm called to teach it. I'm called to instruct. I'm called to help you understand. I'm not called to decide, let's pick and choose what we'd like to believe this week. Because if we do that, you know, take up your cross and deny yourself doesn't sound too good after all. Take up your cross, deny yourself. There has to be a better religion than that. I mean, think of that. But that's what's at the heart of our religion. We don't have the right or the obligation to do that. Well, when we look at what Paul's really saying, that he's saying that there's a relativization to authority and there's limits to authority, we realize this is why you can't chuck this text. Paul himself, in this very text, as he calls the Christians to be good citizens, is making it clear that there's a greater authority to which they will answer and to whom the government will answer. And that there are limits to that authority and they need to recognize that. So if the government ever demands they do something that is against their conscience, they better not do it, because they're to live according to their conscience. He's going to talk more about that in Romans chapter 14. So, that's the text in its culture. How do you fuse the horizon, as they say in homiletics class? You take the horizon of the biblical world, which is not our world, and you take the horizon of the modern world, and you try to fuse the horizons. How does this relate to us living in a democracy? Because Paul, as he writes this, has no capacity to envision a modern democracy. He had no role in his government, and citizens in his day had little to no role in the government. We, on the other hand, constitute part of the government. We, the people. We're the ones that are supposed to give voice and vote. We're the ones that elect our representatives. We're the ones that are called to evaluate and critique the government's activities in so far as we can say, you know, you're not restraining evil enough, or you're not rewarding good well enough, that you're kind of off track. We're called to have that kind of voice. Paul didn't live in a world where that was possible. So since we have that possibility, one of the calls we have, living in good conscience, is to hold the government to its duty to restrain evil and to reward good. What happens when we see that the government's not doing that, or perhaps when it's even reversing the roles? Instead of restraining evil and rewarding good, it's rewarding evil and restraining good. That's when civil disobedience is absolutely justified, when it's time to make our voice heard. But the thing I would have to suggest to many of my activist brothers and sisters, because there are many far more, in fact, everyone's probably more activist than me, you guys know that, is that the way we do it has to be different than the way the world does, because we've been told to honor. We've been told to love. We've been told to show mercy. So Sarah Lancaster, another great theologian, I think puts it well. When we do have to voice, when we do have to speak up, when we do have to dissent, when we do have to be involved in some kind of civil disobedience, she gives good guidelines. She says, even when they resist cultural values, she's speaking of Christians who are addressing their government, they should not do so in a way that seeks to deliberately disrupt the peace of their social world. That already jettisons a lot of the activism we see. Already, because we're not, you know, it's just kind of gone out of that. Paul's concern made good sense in a world that was hostile to the followers of Jesus and where they had little power. In the United States, in our time, protests, strikes, and civil disobedience are accepted ways of attempting to make a change. Paul's warning does not need to eliminate the possibility of making use of such avenues for speaking out, but we would do well also to remember his caution that we should act nobly in the sight of all, even when participating in these methods for change. I find that to be a very helpful corrective word. It makes me think of the Beatles in Revolution. If you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? I'm not in. Noble. Good. It should be something that is meant to bring peace, not that erases peace. Now that, you know, creates quite a challenge, particularly when the civil disobedience is very hot and heated and challenging. But it does allow us to see in our democracy, we're in a little bit different of a place. And because we're in a different place, we do have the call to hold our governing representatives responsible to do the work they're called to do. Now here's where, again, small parentheses, we can sometimes get in trouble. And that's when we're trying to make our government into the church so that it does all our work for us and make sure everyone believes and make sure everyone behaves like a good Christian. That's wrong, and both the left and right does it. They assume the government's the church. They're the ones that should kind of enforce all this stuff so that we behave justly on the left or righteously on the right. That we're making sure that we behave. The government's not the church. The church is not the government. When those two get too deep in collusion, you know who suffers? Not the state, the church. Because it's its witness that I think is made less valuable. The state will always benefit from more people joining their team. But the church, I think, sometimes loses its vibrant witness when it colludes just too closely with governing authorities in trying to make the state into the church. Because you certainly don't want this church to become the state, do you? You do not want me to be your adjudicating judge in telling you how to behave and enforcing when you misbehave. Because you won't like the enforcement. It's painful. And it's mentally just, it'll blow your mind. I'm just kidding. You guys know I'm kidding, right? All right. I had a hard time disciplining my kids. I mean, much less doing that with the church. So when you get to the end of this whole discussion, please realize that I think that what Paul's doing in this text is helpful. I think it's a good word, generally speaking. There are certainly exceptions to it, even within our New Testament. There are exceptions to how the state is viewed. There are exceptions for us in a democracy where we have more of a voice and a vote. But at the end of the day, Paul's doing no more than elaborating on what Jesus said so brilliantly in his aphorism, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and render to God the things that are God's." Which is Jesus' wonderful way of saying, you know, the civil authorities do have some obligation over you. You do have an obligation to them. Pay your taxes to Caesar. But that should never eclipse your even deeper and greater commitment and obligation to God. And do not allow that to take away that obligation to God. And don't think for a second your obligation to God negates your obligation to the governing authorities. Even if they're flawed, even if they are broken. Because that's the best we'll do in a world until Christ returns. That's the best we'll do. The scary thing is people who aren't looking for Christ return that want to make, you know, a utopia without him. Because I don't think that's going to happen. I think history makes that very, very clear. So Jesus is Lord. But until his return, we live in a fallen world. Secular rulers have a legitimate, though not absolute, claim on us. And our obedience to civil authority is our duty. But it's to be exercised within a framework of a more far-reaching commitment of obedience to God. which is no different than the past. When Israel was in exile in Babylon, do you know what the prophet said to the people of Israel? He said, you know, seek the welfare of the city where I've sent you into exile and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find welfare. They're not even home in Jerusalem. They're in exile. And that's how we are framed in the New Testament. We are pilgrims. We are strangers and aliens. The world is not our home. We are citizens of another kingdom. And as we await that kingdom, we wander as strangers and aliens on this earth. And as we wander, instead of being unconcerned about the world around us, Paul is saying, no, be a good citizen. Be concerned. Be concerned that there's the proper restraint of evil and the reward of good. Just like in Israel's time, they were told, you're in a country, it's a pagan country, there's no doubt, it's Babylon. But you're to seek its welfare. And you're to pray for it as a city so that you can shine the light of God's rule in this fallen world. That's why I love this, and I'm going to close with this. In the second century, there is an epistle of Mathetes, which really just means disciple in Greek, to Diognetus. This comes from anywhere from AD 130 to AD 180. And so this is about as close to the New Testament as you can get. And in this epistle, Mathetes writes to Diognetus this word, in a word, what the soul is in a body, this the Christians are in the world. The soul is spread through all the members of the body and Christians through the diverse cities of the world. The soul hath its abode in the body, and yet it is not of the body. So Christians have their abode in the world, and yet they're not of the world. The beautiful phrase he offers is that he assumes that even though we walk as strangers and aliens, pilgrims, in a world that is not perfect, where there are governing authorities that do their job, there are those that do not, that we're called to shine a light. We're called to be like the animating soul in a carcass. We're called to bring healing and life and wholeness and love and truth and the awareness of God's reign that is both now and to come everywhere we go. And a big part of that is longing to be a peacemaker. Longing for the welfare of all those around us. Longing for a society that is ordered and structured, in which evil is restrained so that the bullies and the rich and the powerful do not rule, and where good is rewarded. This is what Paul is getting at, in my opinion, in this text. And this is why I think not only is it worth preserving, it's worth studying and worth obeying and worth committing our lives to trying to be, in this world, in this culture, in this time, the soul to the body. Would you pray with me?